of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam in this sermon says that if you want to remain safe and in the path of truth and in the right direction in these confusing situations whereby your enemy is apparently your friend, looks like you, looks like your friend, looks like your reflection, but in his heart he's something else, then Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَلَا يَحْمِلُ هَذَا الْعَلَمُ إِلَّا أَهْلُ الْبَصَرِ وَالصَّبْرِ, that this flag of this war, of this fight against such an enemy will not be able to be carried, will not be lifted by anyone except that one who has deep insight, أَهْلُ الْبَصَرِ, who is aware, who has awareness and insight, وَالصَّبْرِ, and one who is patience, firmness, and steadfastness. Unless you have these two qualities, you'll be able to distinguish that enemy. If a person doesn't want to be fooled by the enemy and wishes to be in the right direction and take the right step in every move, then the above qualities are necessary. Today, the biggest duty of the people of the world, and of the Muslims especially, of the Shias, of the believers in general, is that they need to raise their insight. They need to increase their foresight, their basira, so that they can combat this sinister form of warfare. Without this, you'll reach a dead end. You will not be able to go ahead. Without insight, without awareness, without scrutiny, without depth, you will not be able to recognize that wolf that is wearing the sheep's skin. You will not be able to recognize this. And that is exactly what the enemies want you to do. The enemies want you to be completely unaware, to be completely ignorant about the realities of this world, about the trickery that the enemy wants to play. They want you to be, I'm sorry to say this, they want you to remain dumb.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, what does this enemy want from us? This tricky enemy that today is in the form of, you can say, these arrogant powers of the world, and the way they have tricked the world with these beautiful slogans of humanity. And at that time, in the time of Imam Ali alayhi salam, the slogans were the same as the slogans of Islam. Today also, the world in general, the Muslims specifically, are facing such enemies. There are stooges of these arrogant powers in different parts of the world that carry apparently the same belief and perform the same practices, but inside their hearts they are different. So what do these enemies want us to do? They want us, the people of the world, to sleep in that slumber of ignorance. They want you to remain simple-minded. They want you to remove you from critical thinking. They want to remove you from that situation where you can critically analyze the political and social dimension of things. They want you to be ignorant and to be completely oblivious of the political dimension of things. They want you to, you know, just ignore that and think about your own life and your own world. But this is a time where you need to reach the depths. You know that today in the books of history, they have removed the whole idea of colonial oppression. If you read American history today, you will not see those evil crimes, the millions of people that were massacred in America and in Australia. These things are hidden under the blanket so that people are not able to see and witness what evil crimes these people have committed. If you look at the media today, they will not show you what Israel is doing day in, day out to the Palestinian people. Why? Because they want you to remain in that state of ignorance. They don't want you to think about the realities. Look at the stories. You remember, if you look at the books of history and of the children's stories, if you read today, you'll see that the children's stories are filled with these dumb fairy tales that have no messages. But if you look at how the olden tradition was, whereby the stories, for example, that had depth and understanding about political and economic and social and other issues were there. Unfortunately, those stories are being removed from the syllabus of the schools. So this is what the enemy wants us to be. Let us pray that we are able to raise this awareness amongst ourselves and in our children and our families, so that we can always see this direction as Imam Ali alayhi salam has rightly pointed out. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in qarn mojiza kardid. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. In the name of Allah, the exalted, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World, a program dedicated to the memory of a great leader and the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. May God bless his soul. We got to the point in this program where we've reached a stage where we've discussed the fact that Imam Khomeini, for those who don't have a belief in religion, will be an enigma. For those of us who do believe in Islam, he's not an enigma. He's the living essence and embodiment of the message of Islam. Dr. Hasni, very well, warm welcome to you on the program. Salam, and thanks for being with us. Yeah, really, we've enjoyed your contributions in the previous programs as well. But Dr. Hasni, as you quite rightly point out, and as we have said over and over again, you said that Imam Khomeini, a great man like Imam Khomeini, is like a mountain. And you said we have to stand back and take the tapestry of the context in which this mountain is located and look at the features of this mountain as well, in terms of its height, in terms of its appearance, in terms of its color. We talked about the fact that Imam Khomeini is a mountain.
You know, the problem with us is this. Mm. We only care about all five senses, you know?
That's right, absolutely.
In order to understand something beyond that.
Beyond that.
You have to go and try very hard in order to understand.
Well, let's go beyond
the significance.
Let's go beyond that. Let's do it. Let's make an attempt, even in our own humble way. As I say, we are not in any way going to fathom Imam Khomeini, because he was a man of God, a true man of God, the way of life of Islam as it should be lived by all of us. And as I say, I myself am personally sometimes ashamed that we are not the kind of Muslims we ought to be in terms of following the legacy of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, let alone following an example like Imam Khomeini. May God bless his great soul. But let's put it in this context. Let's now look at something that, as you say, is beyond those five senses. Because there is something about Imam Khomeini which is beyond those five senses. We talked about that he was speaking from a time, because he speaks from the timelessness of the Quran. Because you told us there's no boundary here, isn't there? It's limitless. So if we want to touch this hikmah, if we want to touch this wisdom, I want to look at the fact that Imam Khomeini has said things which, under normal circumstances, and I mean in the context that many scholars have not said anything different from what Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, may God bless his soul, has said at the end of his life in terms of the legacy of the Prophet being that I leave two weighty things, two valuable things, the Holy Quran and the infallibles, my family. Now, many scholars of the Ahlul Bayt, great scholars of the Ahlul Bayt, great philosophers from the school of Ahlul Bayt have mentioned this. But there are other schools as well, aren't there? There are other schools in the Muslim world as well, which also have their own reasoning, their own philosophy, their own understanding of the Quran. And they don't quite look at things the way we understand them from the school of Ahlul Bayt. And yet Imam Khomeini says the same thing, but the impact is entirely different. Other scholars have said before, but we've had many arguments about this, and there have been many controversial programs dedicated to this subject, that whether this is a sahih, whether this is mutawatir, is this something that really the Prophet was going to do, because he asked for a pen and paper in the last days of his life so that the ummah, the Muslim ummah, wouldn't go astray. Yet Imam Khomeini has done something which even I myself am puzzled by, that he has stated the same controversial statement, which, let it be known to the listeners, is not accepted by many parts of the Islamic Ummah. And yet, you know, we discuss this aspect of walayat.
It's not the status quo.
Yeah, it's not the status quo. And we discuss the fact about the importance of walayat, but many don't accept it. Mm-hmm. Yet Imam Khomeini does the same thing. And we see his posters with the Rushdie affair. You remember that in 89, yeah? Mm-hmm. The Rushdie affair, which was a complete attempt to blaspheme the Quran, to blaspheme the Prophet by the enemies of Islam. And yet we see the fact that Sunni brethren are holding up the posters of Imam Khomeini in light of the fact that he has said something very controversial and for many schools of thought is very difficult to swallow even to this day. And yet we are now seeing the fruits of what Imam Khomeini is saying, may God bless his soul, through the Islamic awakening. Tell us, brother, how did that happen? How does this dynamic work in this context where other scholars, may I say this, unfortunately, couldn't get that across?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Brother Ejaz, again, so many different subjects. First thing first.
Sure.
Talking about the legacy. Hmm. The legacy it is, the legacy it was.
Was. Mm-hmm.
The legacy lives on.
And what it will be. What it will become.
My point is this. Hmm. We always say Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him. This is his last name. Hmm. Referring to the piece of land, the geography that I was talking
sure.
to you about.
Sure.
The last program. But I'm asking you this. What was his short name, first name?
Ruhullah.
There it? You go.
Yeah.
We always say Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him.
Yeah, yeah.
His first name was Ruhullah. Mm. What does it mean?
Spirit
of God.
God. And this is also a title of a great prophet in the Quran.
Exactly. Yeah. You see?
Mm.
And a title him. For a new book to be written.
Yeah.
That's what we can talk about Imam Khomeini. Mm. Imam Khomeini lives within us, every single of us.
Yeah, he does.
The hope, the belief,
Thief.
The struggle,
mm.
the trying so hard to guide every single person on the planet. You mentioned the word Rushdie, supposed to mean guidance, and it wasn't.
Misguided.
Just like Pharaoh claimed to take the children of Israel on the right path, to the right path, and show them the promised land. And he didn't.
No.
He couldn't deliver.
No.
He couldn't come through clean. And it happened to him what he was deserved to be happened to him. So, Spirit of God is the legacy, is the power. Mm-hmm. What is the Spirit of God? Think about it for a second.
This is something now beyond the senses, isn't it?
Exactly. Because we are so entangled with material stuff, materialistic stuff.
We're blind.
You know the expression in the States, it doesn't matter what you do for someone.
Mm.
Let's talk about, for a second,
yeah,
you know, for the sake of argument.
Yeah, yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
Let's talk about in a relationship,
yeah.
a mutual one.
Yeah.
Okay? It doesn't matter the male or female doing for whoever.
Right,
okay?
Right.
For his partner.
Sure.
She always asks, I'm talking about the Western mentality here, because we all live there.
Yeah.
We know this.
Mm.
He said, by the way, what you have done for me lately? There is no satisfaction.
Mm. No satisfaction, right.
It doesn't matter what you do.
Mm.
Okay, you eat, you drink, you wear nice clothes.
Yeah, sure.
You drive nice car.
You're trying to live a good quality of life.
There's no end to it.
Mm.
There is no saturation.
Right.
You always hunger for something. You're always thirsty for something.
Sure.
The Spirit of God, you have to pause for a second. What does it really mean?
Mm.
Why we don't ask ourselves, instead of saying, what you have done for me lately, what you have done for the reality, for the truth lately?
Lately.
That's or likely, like they call it.
Yeah.
What have you done for the truth, for the sake of truth? We always say, you know, this is... It became kind of habit, and habit in the sense that you're not aware of it. This is not a good aspect.
Mm.
Okay? We always say, oh, for God's sake, for God's sake. We always swear by God whenever we need God in that sense in order to fulfill some material needs of ours.
Mm.
We always refer to God. But who actually God is, what kind of attention we pay to this important matter? Why we don't ask ourselves, what have I done for the truth lately? Spirit of God helps us to understand that beyond this worldly, materialistic aspect of life, there is something else to think about.
Yeah. What I'm saying is that, you know, there are two, three elements that come into this.
You mentioned something about the school of thought.
Let me give you another example. Yeah, but what I'm seeing here is there's a combination of things in Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, which left others not able to say contrary to this, where they have been able to do it in the past. And this is what I find is unique here.
Brother, let me give you an example.
Mm. Because, as you say, the Spirit of Allah is like
going back... I'm trying to explain that.
Yeah, it's going back to the fact that of the Quran, as you said, that
exactly.
these are those men who have made a pledge to Allah to give that correct pledge that they are going to do what the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, commanded them to do.
And it could be a broad way of understanding.
Hmm.
Brother, this is a problem with material stuff, okay?
Yeah.
Think about a piece of rock, stone.
Okay.
Okay? Hmm. Solid. This is the lowest level of being, okay?
Sure.
And in the agricultural way of living, we use soil, which is a solid.
Sure, sure.
The lowest level of being.
Yeah, mineral.
We use it, mineral.
Yeah.
We use it to plant trees in it, vegetables.
In order living
to,
things.
In order to make produce.
Yeah.
To be consumed by us, okay?
Sure.
This is one way.
Sure.
So solid for plantation.
Mm.
Then plantation is consumed by animals.
Animals.
Okay, cows eat grass.
Yeah.
They always done.
And always will do. Right.
Okay? Yeah. No matter what. No matter where.
Yeah.
No matter what century. Because last time we were talking about 20th century, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's ironic to think about, oh, when we're talking about 20th centuries, we think we are so modern. We are so sophisticated.
Yeah, yeah.
We're putting a class for someone else.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
We look at different people, different nations.
Mm.
You are inferior. Mm. We are superior to you. Why? Because we live in the 20th century. But it doesn't mean nothing, the way I'm trying to explain it.
That's a very solid, good point.
Solid for plantation.
Mm.
Plantation for animal. Mm. Animal for consumption by human.
Human.
Human for what? This is my question. Mm. This is a problem with the materialistic mentality of looking at things, okay?
From that point of view.
Mm. But you have to think about it.
Mm.
You have to think about it and come with a good answer for yourself first.
Mm.
You have to satisfy your curiosity and your need in order to understand, in order to gain the true knowledge. I'm talking about the true reality here.
Mm.
Because beyond these five senses, there are so many different things. We call it spirit. Spirit is not material.
Mm.
Okay?
Quite.
Remember a few decades away in Germany, okay, this doctor, whoever, in researcher, okay, this guy was passing away.
Mm-hmm.
They thought that they would come up with a new idea in order to prove that there is a spirit or there is not.
Mm.
They put this ready to pass away.
That's right. Yes, they did
on
that.
On this scale, okay? On this sophisticated digital scale.
Yeah.
They're trying to weigh the soul.
Yeah.
Or the guy who went to the moon and said, look, what did you see on the moon? Said, I saw everything but God. I mean, that's a shame. That's very sad.
Yeah.
Okay?
Mm.
So, plantation for animal for human consumption.
Mm.
What is the role of human? What happens? He consumes. Then what happens? This is a question you have to think about.
Yeah.
Everybody has to answer to find a good answer.
In other
for
words, we're going back to what we call in Islam the fitra. We're going back to this primordial nature.
The insight. Yes.
And this is what I'm saying, that Imam Khomeini makes that same statement, that same hadith, and yet the rest of the schools of thought are silent. And not only silent, they're picking up his picture and they're also bearing witness to the fact that this is a man who is the spirit of Allah of our time.
Exactly.
And beyond.
He was Ruhullah before he was Khomeini. Anybody mention his name back days, you know, during the 15 of Khordad, you're talking about 50 years ago.
Mm.
They call him Sayyid Ruhullah. And Sayyid in Arabic is someone who takes care of the rest of them.
Takes care of the rest of them, right.
He's a master. He's a generous. He's a noble.
Mm.
He's a noble one. We don't pay attention. Brother, this is a problem again.
Mm.
We don't pay attention to these words.
Yes,
we think this is only a name.
Yeah.
But name should have someone, you know, to be felt with.
But it has characteristics. It has a personality in itself.
It sure does. He was Ruhullah. Because he was Ruhullah, then if you are attached to God, in that sense that I tried to explain.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay?
Mm.
If you are Ruhullah, number one, you are not scared of nothing.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter how many enemies in front of you.
Mm.
You know, one of the titles for the commander of the faithful. He was Karar. Why? Because he was Ruhullah at the same time.
Precisely.
He was Waliullah. Wali what? He was connected with God.
Mm-hmm.
And God is not material. So it tells us that we shouldn't be trapped in the sense that anything we cannot see with eye, with the physical eye, anything we cannot hear with this earthly ears, okay, vahi, revelation, is some kind of hearing. But not everybody is
able to hear it. Yeah.
So if you cannot hear, if you cannot see it, if you cannot touch, if you cannot feel, if you cannot taste, therefore, it doesn't exist. That's not the case.
No, it's not.
How come that school of, you mentioned something very nice.
Yeah.
The school of thought. The school of thought goes wrong when you put an end, put a ceiling to an understanding.
Well, that's very interesting, isn't it?
If you limit yourself to something, therefore you cannot go beyond. You cannot fly. And the sky is the limit because God is a limitless being, if you will.
And he has to open a limit.
And I'm trying to speak so so simple.
Yeah,
yes.
But you're talking about a gate or a door that has to open to this limitless world.
Exactly. That's why Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him,
says
"Ana Madinatulam." I am the city of knowledge.
Beautiful.
And Aliyum Baba.
Baba.
Ali is the gate. And anywhere you want to, anytime, brother, it doesn't matter where.
Hmm.
This is the manner of doing. Anytime you want to enter a building, a house, how are you going to do it? You're going to jump from the back wall. You're not going to do that. You're going to enter from the gate. But the gate should be the correct one.
Yes.
Okay? This school of thought stops itself from solid. It comes to plantation, which is fine, which is true.
True.
Okay? To the animal level of being, which is true.
True.
And the relationship between each, which is true.
True.
And from animalistic level, you come to human.
Mm.
But you stop there. This is where you go wrong.
Wrong.
This is where you go astray. That's why you see suicide. In Islam, suicide is forbidden. You know why? There's a reason behind it. Anything God tells you, there is a reason behind it. The point is, you might understand, you should understand. Or, if you don't understand, you go look for the truth.
Truth. For the
there
hikmah.
Are people who understand.
Yeah, search for the wisdom.
Okay? Mm. And there might be a case that God is testing you, for example.
Sure.
But at least you understand that God is going to test you.
Test you.
There is no reason. There is wants to put your worshipness, if you will, your being a slave to God, your abd, okay, to God, by testing you. But there is a reason for it. In Islam, suicide is forbidden. Why? Because you don't belong to yourself. This body is not yours. It's
so, in other words,
it's only a deposit.
In other words, what you're saying is, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, through the Bab, through this gate of knowledge.
He went through the right ball.
The right door.
You mentioned something about source.
To the source.
I should add.
Source of the knowledge.
I should add to this.
Yeah.
Source is not enough, brother. Source, the singular.
Yeah, but what I wanted to.
Sources. Yeah. Is not enough. Pure source.
Pure source, yes. The pure source, which is the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, himself.
And he's the pure source.
The pure source. But the point I'm making here is that he'd said this statement, this hadith-e taqlan, to raise the bar for the other schools of
thought. And he did indeed. Imam Khomeini.
That's why they couldn't argue with this point. Because as you see,
you know how you judge a person, a personality? You know how you value someone? When he or she knows his value or her value.
Excellent point.
You are not yourself. You don't belong to yourself. That's why you cannot.
Yes.
You cannot cease your life.
Yeah.
You cannot commit suicide. This is one of the unforgivable sins of all. You can't kill yourself. You don't belong to yourself. This pain is not mine. Can I? It doesn't belong to me. Can I own it?
No, you can't.
Can I own it then destroy it? I can't.
No.
This is only someone gave it to me. Okay, for a higher purpose.
A trust.
Very good. A trust. This is our soul, back to Ruhullah. Our soul belongs to him. This is a divine source, divine spirit. Ruhullah in that sense.
Yes, and Ruhullah in this sense, in the sense of this great personality, has pledged the purity of this soul as a trust to fulfill that
to the only pure source.
Source.
To begin with.
Yeah.
To begin with.
To begin with.
And to end up with, of course, because we are all holding responsible in front of him, in the eye of Allah.
Mm-hmm.
He's the final judge. So you see that? This is it changes the whole story.
It's I mean that has been the key success in terms of bringing the Muslim Ummah together to understand this importance of this concept of Walaya.
And if somebody follows this path, of course he's going to capture the hearts. Why? Because the hearts does not belong to
you because or we mentioned that he's from the masses.
Brother Ejaz, again, hearts, minds, you might manipulate it.
Yeah.
Okay, brainwash.
Yeah.
We have that.
Sure.
But hearts does not belong to me or you or any government for that matter.
Exactly. Exactly. He owns them.
He's the muqallib al-qulub. Remember the the prayer that
please quote from the Quran if you can, you know, for
muqallib al-qulub.
Yeah, as an example.
Him.
Yeah.
And qalb is something that it constantly moves.
It's dynamic.
Struggle.
Yeah.
It's dynamic.
Yeah, it's within the self struggle.
You know, in a medical term, I don't know. I'm asking. All right, we all hear about the different kind of cancers. Okay,
yes, yeah,
all different kind of cancers.
Sure.
So far, I haven't heard about cancer of heart.
No, I've not heard about.
I don't know. No. I might be wrong.
Yeah, I haven't heard about it. No,
but if that's the case, if that
they
would
call
be
it
the
heart
case,
disease, for example,
heart disease, but not heart attack.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what
heart attack. I would say
cardiac arrest.
It's something that you should think about at least.
Mm.
You know, because when you logic with someone, okay,
yeah,
you can push it. You cannot go further.
Yeah,
but the thing is, okay,
yeah,
if someone gets to know somebody, gets to like or to love somebody, which we're supposed to do with God,
yeah,
we have to get to know him.
Know him,
okay?
Yes.
Then we have to love him.
Yes.
And the love comes from knowledge.
Exactly.
That's why, you know, all this, you know, earthly love is not true love. Okay?
No, it's not.
Why? Because there is so many different kind of reasons for divorces.
Yeah.
If you say you love someone, how come you beat them up? You know, the situation of love and hate.
Yeah.
You can love something, somebody,
sure,
and hate it at the same time.
Yeah.
Am I wrong or what?
Sure.
I'm just raising these points in order to think.
Yeah.
Because the subject of this program is to understand.
Yes. But God's love is not...
We are going to try to understand.
Yeah, but God's love is not in that context.
In that context. Okay? Yeah. So, number one, you have to understand. Number two, you have to love.
Mm-hmm.
In order to prove your love, then what have you done for me lately? God can ask us this.
Yes.
On a daily basis.
Yes. And God, he has the right.
Again. And he has the right because he created us.
Sure.
For what? He didn't need us, did he?
No, he didn't.
He didn't?
No.
Why? He gave us favor. He did us a great, unimaginable, unexplainable,
favor.
Boundless.
Boundless favor.
Boundless favor. So, if someone give you a car, for example, you know, car, whatever the price might be, how many times you're going to say, look, I really, truly appreciate you?
Yeah. How many times are you going to say
that? How many times are you going to say that? If someone gives you, you know, a camera, okay? How many times are you going to say, hey, guy, you're so nice.
Yeah,
to me.
You got
thank
it
you.
On Eid, for example.
But God gave us two eyes.
Yeah.
You know, what kind of camera is this?
Yeah.
It works for 80 years.
Yeah.
Without repair in some cases, if you don't ruin it.
Yeah.
If you take care of it.
Yeah.
Okay? But do we tell God every day, God, thank you for eyes. Thank you for giving me ears. We don't. This is
what does
difference.
It say in the Quran?
This is the difference.
What does it say in the Quran that man is mostly ungrateful?
Brother, to make the long story short, and we can go on in the next program.
Yeah.
Okay? The difference between Ruhullah, between Imam Khomeini and me.
Me.
I'm talking about myself here now.
Sure, sure.
Okay? Is that he thinks about this stuff, and he believes in it, and he loves this stuff, and he acts upon it. Period.
And that's why...
And that makes the beauty.
Nobody could argue with him.
Nobody can argue. Nobody can touch it, because he's talking about the truth. You
exactly.
might hide the truth one day, one moment, but you cannot fool everybody all the time.
And I love the fact that, you know, you say this, and I love the way it came. This is another thing. It's not something that Imam Khomeini
the
is...
The way it was to come.
The way it was to come. Thank you for that. Thank you. I mean, there's an order to this. There's a logic you can follow with this as well. That certain events happen, over that 10-year period as the Imam was living, he puts it into a context where people are beginning to see the unimaginable, beginning to taste the unimaginable, the impossible. As you said right at the beginning, mm-hmm. the impossible is becoming a reality in the late 20th century. And as we get to the end, he puts it, this context of this hadith, after we see the fall of communism. He's already sowing the seeds to show that this is the path we've got to go on after you see the collapse of this. We'll discuss it in the next session. But thanks,
God willing, we do.
Thanks, Dr. Hassani, for the valuable contribution on this program. It's been really excellent and remarkable. Thanks a lot, because when we talk about this personality, really, we open up some really remarkable doors. And all, it leaves me to say, wa assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and blessings and mercy of Allah be upon you all. And thanks for listening.
He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
British sport is once again under fire, and for an all too familiar problem, racism. This time the story flared up in English cricket when one Yorkshire cricketer, Azim Rafiq, revealed to a parliamentary committee that in his experience racism, without a shadow of a doubt, was widespread. He also claimed that, instead of facing up to the need to deal with it, abuse from his colleagues was not tackled and instead treated as a joke or friendly banter.
Giving evidence to the Parliamentary Digital Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee, Azim Rafiq stated English cricket is institutionally racist. He recounted the inhuman treatment he endured after his son was still born in 2017. Also, according to Rafiq, in cricket, racist language was used constantly, never stamped out, and the norm, and people didn't think it was wrong. Similar issues have also been reported in English football, with visibly ethnic players repeatedly enduring abuse from the terrace and from other players. The impact has been relentless and corrosive. In Azim Rafiq's case, he believes he lost his career to the effects of racism over a prolonged period. However, former footballer John Barnes, who echoes the concerns and revelations of Azim Rafiq, does not think the impact of such revelations will be an end to the issue. He believes institutions will just scapegoat people and think we're making a change by increasing ethnic representation in sport.
Why, after all these years, do racism and other forms of ethnic abuse appear to remain endemic in British sport? And what message does it send out to fans who watch from the terrace and see this sort of behaviour on the pitch? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. To what extent should sports people in the United Kingdom feel able to compete completely free of any form of racial abuse? We put that question to the public here outside London's iconic cricket ground, the Oval. Here's what they said.
Anyway, that's another story. Let me just ask you the question.
There was a lot of talking about that. Yeah.
Ready?
Okay. So there's no test of knowledge. I'm just going to fire a couple of questions and see what you think.
You're welcome. We're here at Oval today. And
we're here today at the Oval. And yeah. We're asking the public... The recent allegations of racism in sport.
Sorry.
No. First question. To what extent should sports people in Britain be able to compete without racist abuse?
Yeah, of course there shouldn't be no racism at all.
I mean, it sounds extremely unfair that for so many they do end up going to play and just get heckled and their focus is drawn away from the sport that they're playing and suddenly their identity is being attacked.
Well, there's no racism, there's no discrimination of any kind. Everybody just kind of gets brought together. That's what I love about sport.
Well, of course, you shouldn't have to worry about anything like that. You know, sport is sport. There shouldn't have to... Any of those sort of issues shouldn't come anywhere near the sport, you know.
To what extent do you think that British sports people should be able to do their sport without any fear of racism or religious discrimination?
Oh, 100%.
Why?
Well, because it's not relevant to the sport that they're playing.
I know nothing about cricket, but what I know is that it's completely international, it's all over the world, so that's beautiful, it's something that should bring people together, not apart.
Yeah, of course. Like, I think races and all this stuff, it's been, like, you know, for ages.
It's a great shame. It's something that's an ongoing battle by all accounts.
I'm from abroad. I can't imagine there's racism in British sports.
I believe racism is inborn.
Yes.
It's not avoidable easily.
Do you think that British sports people should be able to compete without fear of racist abuse?
I do. Unfortunately, it's very rife and has been for a very, very long time.
They said something on the news this morning. There's this whole thing about people excuse racism by saying it's banter. And this whole thing about bants that has suddenly become a byword for I can get away with saying anything. Oh, it's just bants, which it's not.
In reality, there is still racism ongoing. We know that is true. There's racism ongoing.
In the honesty of all of it, there shouldn't be any fear of it. I think we've come a long way. Like, British history in regards to colonialism has come a far, long, long, long way. 21st century, there shouldn't be any fear.
To be honest, I don't think any racism I observed. Absolutely. Yeah, it isn't just racist abuse, it's about sexist abuse, it's about inclusion. Everyone should be able to get to the best that they can possibly be.
People should be able to freely participate in any sport.
How does the public feel about cricketer Azim Rafiq and footballers claiming that British sport is institutionally racist?
Institutionalised? I'm not really sure. I wouldn't be able to give a definite opinion on that, but... I mean, I can understand that there might be some elements to suggest that.
I think we've been letting it go on for too long, and in that sense it is institutionalised, it's part of the system.
In my standard and in my understanding, it was so exaggerated, and I disagree with you.
I couldn't tell you much about it, to be fair, Paul, but I did see a little bit, and if as the case obviously needs to get stamped out.
Everyone that is racist or thinks racism should belong somewhere, wherever it might be, should not exist, in my opinion. Like, honestly, just change your mind. It's not a thing. It's 2021. Get over it.
That's kind of disappointing because we're at, like, 2021, so we should be able to do whatever we want.
It's sad. You know, the fact is that we try to combat so many different elements, but it's still there.
There's one expression here in English language saying this is not cricket. So this means to me cricket is a very, very fair sport and it's to be open-minded to everybody.
Racism is not a good feeling. The outcome is horrible. People should really accept everyone.
I've lived in this country for about 40-something years. My family live in Australia. And I've always gone on about, in Australia, the racism, the sexism, the homophobia was always in your face. So you knew it was there and you could deal with it. In this country, there's a whole veneer of politeness. I didn't realize how misogynist men were in this country. It took me about 10, 15 years to work it out. And if I think that's the same thing, I think that's probably the same with racism.
I'm not surprised to hear about that because I know that racism is many places in this country. is practicable many places, both secretly and openly. We know of that.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was institutionally racist, but I think it's got opportunity to grow. You know, he would know more about it because he's in the field. But yeah.
And it makes me feel sad, but at the same time, it's just the reality. I mean, the British, the UK is quite institutionally racist.
I think it's been acknowledged that there is a massive problem that needs to be addressed. It may be not just in our sport, it might be across the culture of the country, but we're definitely going to deal with it.
Why is there still so much racism in British sport, is the public's opinion.
Just because England has got such kind of deep tradition, deep culture, especially with kind of like the British Empire colonialism only ending about, what, like 50 years ago.
I wish I knew. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible thing. I know, I'm lucky I don't experience anything like that myself, but I imagine it's terrible.
Don't know why. It could be jealousy. They earn plenty of money.
I think there was just an unawareness of, you know, what multiculturalism actually meant.
I couldn't tell you the reason why. I don't think it's sport specific, but I think obviously with the emotions of sport, it comes out a little bit more. But either way, it's got no place.
Because sport is just, you know, a microcosm of of society.
To be honest, I think it's always been there. It's just like now we have more voice to say. Like before, as you say, we've been like, a lot of people, a majority has been living with fear. And now we know, like, we are actually 2021 and we be able to express ourselves.
Because I think it's something that is institutionalized. Unfortunately, that goes back many, many years.
When people are good, people have reason to pick on them. If people can't be like you, they want to antagonize you. As simple as that.
I think it's always been there and always will be. Hidden under the carpet, brushed under the carpet, whatever you call it. But I think it will always be anti-this, anti-that.
It's something of mine, because I know black people have contributed a lot to this country. You see, when black people do things good, they will say they are British. But when they commit crime, then they will say they are Nigerians or they are Afghanistanian or they are from Ghana.
I think the irony is fair, like, and that's the irony to the first question you asked, if there should be any fear around it. I think all racism comes from just fear, it's just ignorance.
I think, British people, they are very sporting, sporting-oriented people. And I read that is oil from my side.
They have this imperialist domination of the world that they show in the news and everywhere, and so that they think that also, you know, they are entitled to discriminate other because their country discriminate other countries.
I think it's culture. I think the difficulty is culture, is that maybe that communities aren't encouraged to mix and understand each other.
Research by the Professional Cricketers Association revealed 25% had witnessed or experienced racism. Among ethnic cricketers, that figure rose to over 58%. 45% said it came from another player, with 39% saying it came from fans or on social media. 62% said it was disguised as banter. In football, using pre-COVID data, reports of racism rose by 43% between 2018 and 2019, with faith-based discrimination, including Islamophobia, going up by 75%, more than any other form of abuse. Over 70% of fans across England now think professional football in the country has a serious problem with racism. We asked the public, what impact does racism on the pitch have on racism in the audience?
I think that professional players in any sport, cricket, football, anything, they need to be role models, they need to be better, because they need to understand that their behaviour on the pitch is going to be emanated by thousands, by millions, potentially, of fans.
I think it's completely dependent on the fan. I mean, if the fan is
you know, anti-racism. It's devastating if they are a racist. Suddenly, their minds, their way of thinking is actually being backed up, and they're suddenly believing it to be acceptable.
The fans, they are not the very educated people, or there's so many different mixed group. Yeah, some of them maybe they are idiot or they say some things, but we cannot accuse whole country because of some idiot in the fans. We cannot say that. Yeah, it could be.
Do fans take their lead from players, what they see on the pitch? Is that, you know, there's an influence there?
I don't think so, but you never know. Everyone's totally different, but I don't think so. I don't think you see anyone specifically going from players themselves.
You know, if you're a public figure, you influence people in the bad way, in the good way. You get influenced by them.
Well, I'm assuming that the majority are going to be appalled if they see anything like that on the pitch. But then there's always going to be percentage that are like, you know, thanks for, you know, raising that I am a bigot and I want to be able to voice my bigotry. So, yeah.
I think in certain way, yeah, it could influence a lot, because, I mean, it depends of your mentality also, you know, like of your backgrounds.
There's still a lot of people out there that have their own views and try to put their views onto other people.
It affects people in different ways. Why is that? Because there's a certain, I'd say, middle class, establishment, whatever. There's this thinking that's that English exceptionalism. Get over it, guys, you know?
Sometimes it makes potential immigrants to feel unsafe to come to this country. And at the same time, it makes many of us too, who have more things to contribute to the society, to reserve some and say, no, I better go and contribute this thing in another country where I'd feel I'll be safer and I will not experience such kind of racism that is obtainable here.
The racism on the pitch, if it's not addressed, I mean, it's legitimized, you know?
We asked the public to comment on their view about what racist abuse in sport tells us about the state of racism in Britain.
I'd say that in sports, kind of like the true nature is brought out when you're kind of cheering for your fans, and it can get a bit crazy. I think that if there is racism there, it does show a lot about kind of what's in the true nature of British people, and it's quite sad to see that as well.
There's clearly like a plague, a virus of racism that still, you know, is deep embedded in the system, and it shouldn't be there. It should, you know, should be out, you know, something that players shouldn't have to worry about, and not something they have to, you know, worry about when they come to do the thing they love doing.
Well, I think it's a reflection of where we are as a society in some respects. I don't think it's any better or any worse, actually. I mean, I think, I was just reading this morning that the incidence of stop and search of black people in London has gone up by 24%.
It's not nice, it shouldn't be happening, and the fact that it keeps popping up is disgraceful.
Well, it doesn't say anything nice, but it's not like other countries don't have it. Like, it's not a British problem. It's a problem that every nation has, whether it's in sports or, I don't know, the show business, anything public.
No, it's the same all across the world, I think. Don't matter just this country. It might be more publicised in this country, but it happens all over the world.
They always try to help me, and that's, I think, is another face of like London or like UK, because yeah, it have all this stuff that you're saying, but I also experience like the way that people help me a lot, and people has been being so helpful.
Well, Britain knows is there, is the head, and people are looking over, you know, up to them for good behavior and really giving people the satisfaction they want and tackling things like racism as it should be. So they should do better than this.
So what does racism in sport say about racism in Britain on the international stage?
Well, it's worrying, isn't it? It is worrying.
It gives a very negative reputation about the British society. The British society is a good place, it's a nice place to stay, to live, an organized society. But I think there are a few members of the society here who are practicing such racism that seems to be done by majority of the society of Britain, which is not the majority that practice that racism. It's just a few of them, but it's just that the few people that practice the racism here, they are dominant. That is the thing.
I think Britain is not as racist as other places. However, is it perfect? No. So it is a landmark, but it's got some stains on it, so it can be cleaned.
You know, the UK is part of the United Nations Security Council, and we've seen how they have undermined other countries at the international level, you know, with their culture, you know, the capitalistic, vicious capitalistic domineering culture, and it just transpires at the local level.
Yeah, I think the world is watching. The world is watching to make sure that we change our processes. And it's within cricket today, the meeting of every county board, all aspects of cricket has come to a conclusion that things need to change and things need to, and we need to engage with people. We need to actually engage and say, how can we make this right?
The evidence given by cricketer Azeem Rafiq confirms what many cricket players, footballers and other sports people have known for years. Racial abuse in Britain is widespread and committed by both players and fans. Many have their own stories of abuse to tell and can confirm that racist behaviour is frequently dismissed as a joke or not taken seriously by the organising, governing bodies of the sports.
These damaging revelations of a culture of racism in cricket, football and beyond suggest a deeply established presence of religious and ethnic abuse in British sport. And despite words of outrage from sports bodies and politicians, it still continues after all these years. Either because, at least until now, the sporting world couldn't put a stop to it, or because, quite simply, it hasn't cared enough to really try.
Thank you.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being. Yeah,